From Milwaukee, welcome to The Phi Effect, where any film is open for discussion. You're listening to Matthew Baltz,
Jason Callen,
and Jacob Radian.
Today we're going to be discussing last week's theme of chase sequences, inspired by our review of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. But first, we're going to be reviewing Fantastic Four, directed by Josh Trank.
Dr. Storm, we gave you 6 years and millions of dollars, and you gave us nothing. What's different now?
Reed Richards. He knows answers to questions we don't even know to ask yet. This is our chance to learn more about our planet and maybe even save it.
I want you to meet my daughter, Sue.
You want to be famous?
I just want my work to make a difference.
John, Reed.
This guy doesn't take orders well.
Yeah, especially from people who say, I don't take orders well.
Don't let any of these lab coats give you any crap, all right?
Well, if I do, I know who to call. The muscle.
I gotta say, it's fun having you here.
Really?
No.
What you've created here is incredible.
You guys sure you're in the best shape to be doing this?
Yeah.
Fantastic Four is an adaptation of the comic book series, which was made into a movie twice. Once by, what was his name?
What, Roger Corman?
Yes. Do you remember what year that was?
1994.
And that movie never saw the light of day until the internet came around.
The internet is a glorious device.
And then we had another film directed by...
Tim Story.
And that was a couple of years ago.
2005.
Yep.
And followed by a sequel in 2007.
So now we
also
have Josh...
directed by Tim Story.
Now we have Josh Trank's version. Josh Trank has only directed one previous feature film. That was Chronicle in 2012, which made a lot of money and had very good reception all around. Otherwise, Fantastic Four, it stars Miles Teller, Michael B. Jordan, Kate Mara, Jamie Bell, Toby Kebbell, and Tim Blake Nelson. I'm going to be talking about that guy later. But first, what was the opening box office for the weekend?
The weekend box office was about $25.7 million, if you round.
That was all domestic?
Yeah, I assume that was the opening weekend domestic. And then so far, so I guess for the past 5 days, combined domestic and foreign has been about $64.9 million. So yeah, $65 million.
And the budget was like twice that.
Yeah, 122 is what some reports say. And usually budgets don't figure in advertising.
Yeah, critics and audiences have not been nice to this movie. But let's find out if it was worth the ticket price. I'll go ahead and start us off. I'm just going to say that I didn't think this movie warranted all of the immense hatred that it seemed to be getting. I will say it's not good. I would describe it as being a battleground of conflicting visions. I would actually think of it as three different parts. The introduction to this movie I thought was actually pretty well done. It introduces us to these characters, and it had a satisfactory method of, you know, establishing kind of some of these relationships, especially between the star Miles Teller and Jamie Bell's character, who basically our childhood friends from the very beginning. And their relationship, I thought, was actually pretty interesting as it developed throughout the movie. Then as we get to Act 2, things get very scientific. The adventure really starts to jack up. And things become very rushed, I would describe it as. The third act, I think, is where a lot of voices would probably say that the movie needed to get faster. It needed to get into the action, because that's when a lot of character is just kind of left by the wayside, and we are rushed into the villain. We are rushed into the
climax.
Yeah, we're rushed into the climax. We're rushed into a lot of seemingly obligatory fight sequences. Yeah, I feel like somebody said we need to get to the action already. So I wasn't really a fan of how this movie developed. I'm sure a lot of people hated the way it developed. But I think some things were handled fairly well. The way that characters were developed, when they were developed, I think was handled all right. A lot of things that I expected to be really cheesy, such as the phrase clobbering time, I was basically waiting for that to come up and hit me over the head. But it was, of all the things I expected to just come out and be very, very cheesy and very silly, that was not one of them. Jason, what did you think of Fantastic Four?
Well, first I got to ask you a question about that clobbering time statement there. Did you hear it both times? Because they say it twice in the movie.
I remember the first time that it is said at the very beginning when we are introduced to Ben Grimm's character. The second time, oh boy, did I block that out?
No, it's the first time that I thought maybe you missed, which was like the one that had the comic fans like in an uproar that they would use his catchphrase in such a depressing manner and make it. Yeah, yes.
Bullying.
Yeah, so I was just curious if you
really were fans up. Were fans up?
Yeah, I saw
about
like
that?
One, you know, a couple threads
that makes kind of some sense though.
Yeah, if you're a real stickler for adherence to the comic.
Well, not just in terms of comics, but just in terms of like the fact that he, I don't know.
Let's bring it up later.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty stupid both times they used it. I didn't think they really needed to use it at all. But anyway, the movie as a whole, I kind of agree with you. I think it's getting a little bit more slandered than it really has to. Like, I don't think it deserves like half of the stuff that people are saying, and I think like people aren't even seeing it and then they're talking shit about it, and it you can just tell. I think that rush feeling that you're talking about, which I agree with, I think that comes from cuts. Like, scenes are truncated and you can just feel it. You feel like a conversation will be going along and all of a sudden it'll be like, okay, here's the end of the conversation, I'm leaving. And this happens like 3 or 4 times throughout the movie where you can just feel that there was more there. And even though it would make the movie longer, it would have helped the pacing. These cuts, these butchered scenes were so obvious that it destroyed the pacing of the movie. You know, bringing on this quicker in a sense, because you're like, you're getting to everything, like, because you're skipping so much, you're getting to the action, I guess, faster, but also makes it slower and more tedious to watch. I felt like it would have felt shorter had they completed these scenes. I thought the relationship between Bell and Teller, Richards and Grimm was pretty interesting. I thought that they really had something working for them at that point. And I thought like Grimm's transformation, like that's a horrifying moment in the movie. And like, I thought it was really handled well, where he's just kind of like screaming, help me. And he's just this pile of rocks. And he's just like, help me, help me. I thought like, I was like, wow. Like at that point I was like, man, are people going to be totally wrong about this movie? Cause that moment really worked for me. Of course it doesn't like everything. Like it doesn't really go anywhere because they cut out the meat of the film, which would have been, I'm sure, the building of the relationships. But I liked that Cronenberg influence that Trink talked about was really present. Like, yeah, you could definitely feel it. And I feel like that's probably why the movie's been butchered, because it probably went too far in that direction and they became uncomfortable that it was so dark, that it was like just so far removed from the other movies and from the comics. But not a good movie. You can't call it a good movie. But I would certainly watch it again before, you know, at least 2 or 3 of the other movies we've done for this podcast. So that's saying something.
Yeah.
It was interesting to behold, I guess. Anyway.
I'm going to follow up with you guys where I agree that I don't think this movie deserves as much vitriolic hate as it's getting. Of course, you know, I didn't really think much of the film, but then again, I don't really go into superhero films expecting much. I expect to be disappointed from the start, just because I hate superhero films, and that's been established. I could see that it was trying at times, and I think there were some aspects of the film that I really liked. At least the first part of the film, it did seem like they were trying to do some character development, and most of that kind of went by the wayside, unfortunately, by the final act. But that, and I really liked just getting into the technical aspects, I really liked the lighting in this film. For some reason, usually I don't notice that in particular, but I'm like, damn, this film is like really well lit, or at least lit to give off this kind of like darkish mood that it was going for. And yeah, unfortunately, I like you guys also said, the pacing is one of the main problems, and that was the problem, because even though it, like, each scene felt like it was going by really fast, there are just so many like exposition kind of scenes and just scenes in general where it felt like they were trying to fit a little too much in not enough time. So even though each scene may be only like a minute long, there's just so many of them where it just keeps dragging on, and it's just, okay, we're still, you know, getting to know these characters. The main event that has given them powers hasn't happened yet. And then it's like, okay, that happens, but now we're just in this facility. What's going on from here? And then, of course, it feels even more jarring by the end because the climactic battle happens and it's over in a matter of minutes.
It's like 10 minutes of screen time, I think, for that final.
Exactly.
I had no problem with that. I just had a problem with, I mean, okay, a final battle, a very short, brief, but poignant final battle, I can get behind. But when it damn near emulates the climactic battle of the previous Fantastic Four film.
I honestly can't recall the end of the previous one. But, I mean, to introduce Doom and have, like, you only get Doom for, like, this last little bit of film. I guess that's the complaint. It's like, you know, you just don't get enough of him. It's like he they go back to the planet, they get him, they bring him back. And it's all like hell breaking loose within such a short period of time. Like, you don't even have time to process the climax, really.
I would rather say I wish there was more of that fight than say I wish they had cut some of that fight out.
Fair enough. But I'm not even talking about just the fight. Like, you could have had more, I don't know, just more with Doom as this, like, hybrid planet human thing. Like, do more with it. Like,
oh, no,
give us
he
more
was, his character was hands down the most fascinating character after he becomes Dr. Doom, of course. In my opinion, he was the most fascinating character because that aspect of his powers was fascinating. Like, this planet, the relationship between him and this planet, the fact that he adores that dimension so much where all we see is just barren rock.
Right, right. But he's not human anymore. Go ahead.
Kind of going off of that, I just find one of my problems was because the film is just going so quickly through everything and we don't really get to spend much time on certain scenes, or sometimes we spend more time on scenes that don't need to be focused on that much, it feels like we're going through all of the characters too quickly. So even though they're trying for some interesting character development, like you mentioned, like the relationship between Reed and Ben, and then I think even both of the Storm kids with their father, it seems like they've got little bits, hints here and there, but because it just goes from one scene to the other so fast, it's like they either try to resolve it too quickly and then just move on, or it's just left in the dust. Because I think one of the ones that I noticed, which was with Kebble's character, Doom. Oh, yeah, I guess he was Doom even before his transformation. It was one of the cheesiest names ever. I was just like, oh, no.
Yeah, I wonder if
no.
he's going to be a villain.
Yeah, exactly. But I think they tried, like, hinting at that there was something between him and Sue Storm, but they never really, like, went into that. And then they tried to go into it, but then, again, it was just rushed away quickly because it's like, oh, we're going to test out the machine now. More time should have been spent on everything here.
I would love to see an extended version of this because you know there's footage out there that was cut out. There's footage in the trailer that is not in the movie. There are scenes that come out of nowhere that have certainly already been set up. I mentioned this to Jacob. We saw it in the same theater, and I brought this up to him in the middle of the film. I leaned over and I said, why is Miles Teller, who is supposed to be on the run from these government officials, standing next to the doctor just off screen? They do not show him in any close-ups, but in the establishing wide shot, I am 99% sure he was standing next to the character talking with the government official, Dr. Allen.
After he supposedly escaped?
During the period where he is supposed to be living in South America or whatever.
I don't know. It could be any number of things, I suppose. Like a different scene that they, like, overdubbed.
It's got to
used
be.
And thought nobody would notice. Who knows? I didn't notice it myself.
I can't imagine how much this film must have been butchered.
But on, you know, as far as extended cuts, too, I would be interested in that, too. I would love to see the Josh Trank cut of this movie. And I don't understand, like in this day and age where director's cuts are so ubiquitous, why isn't that just part of the contract? Like, you make this movie, you know, in the event that we change it to a degree that you're not comfortable with, you have this director's cut that will be released, that we will market, that, you know, like, why don't they foresee these kind of things? They hire these young directors who, like, are trying to make a name for themselves and have their own unique kind of thing, and they get something that, like, I thought had the potential to be that, and they screw them over because they get cold feet. You know, I don't. There should be some kind of, like, back end thing where, like, you know, okay, we're gonna screw you over, but here, not entirely. How's this for you? I don't know. Just seems.
We'll see that.
Silly this day and age. Sorry, go ahead, Jacob.
I don't know. That's the weird thing, especially in this case, because there seem to be a lot of mixed reports where it seems like, you know, the studio screwed over Josh Trank, and that is probably a possibility. But then there are a lot of other reports and sources saying that this was actually like the version that he wanted. Because I'm looking at this Entertainment Weekly article right here, and it says that he was bullish on the success of Fantastic Four, sent emails to actors and colleagues on the film praising the finished product, boasting that it was better than 90% of comic book movies that have been released, despite the struggles to get it made. Maybe he was just maintaining that practice false positivity, but some who work closely with him think the devastatingly negative reviews made him panic and decide to distance himself publicly.
I had heard similar reports. I was actually reading this article from Hollywood Reporter titled Fantastic Four Blame Game, Fox director Josh Trank square off over on-set chaos. And they basically talk about how before the film had opened, he was praising this version of his that he had created, but stated that it would probably never be seen. And it goes on to describe how messy production became, how he became rather reclusive and withdrawn and wouldn't take help from a lot of people. But as it states, it's a blame game. There was blame on both sides. So I don't think we'll ever know for sure who's to blame for this version and whether there is a better version out there.
Yeah, and I'm not like trying to like side with the studio with my claim. It just seems so strange that he came out so quickly to denounce the film, whereas other situations where it seems like a few months have gone by and then they're like, yeah, this has happened, because at least you want to maybe try to give the film some breathing room or something.
And this isn't the first time that we've heard something like this. I feel like it's almost becoming a trend for directors to become very outspoken about their own movies if it's not doing well. Colin Trevorrow did the same thing with Jurassic World when that came out.
That did well from the first
well.
Second that it was
yeah.
It did well, but the criticisms it received, particularly for the chauvinistic angles that people were claiming, he came out and said that those were not in his favor. I've seen it before, and I'm worried that this is going to become some sort of habit of these film directors, that they're not going to own up to the choices that they had.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things now with social media is that maybe if they're really that despondent about a cut, they think that if they voice their opinion beforehand, if they can get it out beforehand, maybe social media will give a push, you know, because people, you know, if there's a big enough push, like, studios will listen, or like things get made, and you know, it's not impossible for things to happen. So maybe I could see why he might want to put it out there. As far as a trend, I don't know. Like, I don't see like people denouncing their own work becoming too trendy, because you know, it's pretty fucking lame.
It is.
It's pretty sad. You know, I don't think people really want to go, you know, spend all this time. You spend years in pre-production and production and all that. And then, you know, oh, I'm just going to, you know, just hey, so I can trash it.
Hey, social media can be unforgiving. If people hate your film, how are you going to react?
Well, I mean, the thing is that, like, nobody had seen it yet. Like, most of the criticisms that he was worried about were, like, people who hadn't even really seen the film yet. They were criticizing the production, and they were criticizing, like, what they had heard his role was, or how he might or might not have behaved during the production.
Well, no, he released that criticism, though, like Thursday night, after all of the big publication reviews had, once the embargo had been lifted, and then all the publications were coming out, and then it's like, Rotten Tomatoes, 9%.
This movie, but it's not good, but I feel like Trank isn't the reason this isn't good. This feels like a studio butcher job. This feels like Alien 3 to me. That's the parallel that I see with this whole production thing. The difference being that Trank was on board the whole time for this movie, whereas in Alien 3, Fincher was brought in after a series of directors. But it's the same kind of thing. And Fox, again, with their interference and their inability to really like get behind these young directors. You know, they tip their toe and say, oh yeah, this guy's he's pretty warm here. All this money we made off his little movie, like, let's give him this big advance on a huge franchise, and then they get cold feet again. I think I already used that term, but that's kind of how it feels. They back off. They get scared. And another you know, parallel. It's like, this is like a dark vision, like, whereas Alien 3 was, again, like a very dark vision. Like, they're not comfortable with the, you know, their summer blockbusters not being all happy ending.
Yeah, and you were talking about how Ben Grimm's character, the Thing, how that, the darkness, or the disturbing aspects of his transformation, those were the parts that I thought showed the greatest potential of, you know, the character development.
Right.
What the characters are dealing with and their relationships and how they act. And even, I'll admit, even in the
2005 version? Roger Corman version?
No.
Not the Corman version.
Even in the 2005 version, I thought the Michael Chiklis' version of the Thing, I thought that was one of the more interesting characters, because we see him dealing with him and his wife.
Right.
And how she reacts to his transformation. And
right.
I thought that was
he's got
more
the most,
interesting.
Yeah, he's got the most extreme transformation, obviously.
He can't turn it off.
He can't turn it off. And it's, you know, he can't be in public. He can't, you know, his entire life is over. And I feel like, you know, some of that stuff that's in the trailer that didn't make it into the movie, they show on, like, the monitors when they're going over. I think they're talking to Reed, or I don't even know who they're talking
like
to.
Like him destroying the tanks.
Yeah, him destroying the tanks.
Those like are in the movie, by the way.
They is are. That one in? Maybe that one was.
Yeah, it is.
Jason zoned out for a little bit.
But literally, it is just them looking at a monitor of things he's done, and then they go to meet him.
Right. I think that, I wonder, I guess, like, if that's not the where the heart of the movie would have been, like his becoming like the weapon for the,
mm-hmm.
I feel like there was a lot more that could have gotten to that point where they're like.
Between the period where he first transforms into the Thing and the period where we see him tearing up the tanks, there's that 1 year ellipsis.
Right.
That we don't get to see all the interesting. I would have liked to see a movie of just that time period.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's the heart of like the transformation is all going to happen in that time period.
When he makes this deal with the government to basically do their bidding.
Right.
There were a lot of jumps like that too, because I thought there was another one where it's like 6 months later and then a few weeks later. It's okay. This is weird.
I feel like there were.
Again,
I mean,
I think there's probably at least.
It added to that feeling of rushed, but at the same time, also too much going on, and it just felt like it was dragging, just mm-hmm. because it was trying to do so much at the dragging along, and then all of a sudden, whoop, jumped ahead.
Yeah, it's like I was saying, like the longer version probably would have felt shorter, or a longer version
mm-hmm.
probably would have felt a lot shorter.
Just going to that fact too, it's kind of weird how short it is. I mean, because if you think of it, almost most movies, especially like big, not even superhero films, but like action blockbusters, are almost always over 2 hours, or at least 2 hours, but more nowadays. It seems like they're always.
Oh, was it really? That's very short. Yeah.
It seems like maybe this is just me and not being attentive, but it seems like a lot of movies are pushing like, you know, 2 hours 15, 2.5 hours nowadays, just because I don't know if it's. People want their money's worth for their ticket, or if they're just trying to get as much action in as possible to entertain everybody. But movies, especially of this caliber, you never really see under 2 hours, and especially this short, which is almost just slightly over an hour and a half.
Well, there's always been very lengthy movies that come out. I feel like I've seen numerous graphs that chart film lengths and, you know, box office and Oscar nominations,
mm-hmm. sure.
the length of these movies. But especially after The Dark Knight came out a few years back, mm-hmm. I've seen a steady increase of imitation of that film, and I don't think superhero movies have been the same since then.
In terms of length?
Yes.
I think they were always kind of on the lengthy side. Even back, like, the original Superman is plus 2 hours. I want to say it's like 2 hours and
Which
15
one?
Minutes.
I'll look it up.
Richard Donner's Superman from 1979. I feel like, yeah, the first one. And the second one was probably closer to like 2 hours.
78 film?
Yeah, 78.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It's clocking in just under 2.5 hours.
Yeah. Action movies in general, I think, vary, but superhero movies certainly, like all, like both the Amazing Spider-Man movies, all the Nolan stuff.
Well, like
it's all over long.
Mission Impossible, which we just saw, was about 2 hours 10 minutes.
So 2 hours minus the credits.
What was the?
I think with an action movie of that type, a Mission Impossible's type, you're pushing it at 2 hours, even though that one worked, because to be an action movie, you got to be kind of relentless.
Ghost Protocol was about the same.
Anyway,
I don't know. It was just something I noticed, and it just seemed.
No, it's.
Which does go along with the possibility that maybe it was, you know, cut out of his control. I don't know.
It certainly felt like it. Like, I can't see a director, like, making some of those decisions, really, if he had any faith in his work.
I'm skeptical about it just because of the whole situation. I'm not siding with either Trank or the studio.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
It just seems like there was some miscommunication along the way and some clash of ideals regardless, but 'tis what it is.
Just a build-up for a big extended edition release around the holidays next year so that they can make their money back.
And it's interesting you say it was only like with young directors, because yeah, they probably do that more often just because they're a little more easy to mold and stuff like that.
Sure.
But specifically with Fox, didn't they release Ridley Scott's The Counselor? Because the director's cut is what everybody praised once it was out on DVD.
Right.
But the theatrical cut, I think they said the studio did some meddling with that too, and that's why it was almost hated by everyone. And he's like a seasoned director. He's like,
I'm not sure. I didn't read anything about the actual details of that production and why it ended up getting cut. He's a seasoned director, but that's, I guess, maybe not the type of movie they're used to. It's, you know, again, kind of a downer, like, you know.
Yeah.
McCarthy, you know, is known for...
He's not known for the happiest of material.
So maybe, again, the fact that it's just a little grimmer than they're comfortable with, which I think is just so boring.
Anyways.
Should we get back to Fantastic Four? Or...
Fantastic Four.
Should we talk about Philip Glass and, like, how they wasted him?
Yes, please. I think he's finally just throwing in the towel.
I don't even know, like...
I remember the day... Because he did the soundtrack for the 1992... horror film Candyman, and I will admit it makes an attempt, but he hated what they did with that. Hated the fact that it was basically just a slasher film, and you know, for as much resistance as he has shown, I feel like he's scoring everything now. Him and Desplat.
Desplat's over, like, I like him, but he's a little overused right now. It's just him and Giacchino.
I don't know, Glass, to me, when he does movies, it's always interesting because he just doesn't really do that many, unless I'm just not seeing the movies he's doing.
It sounds like
I'm curious because, like, when this movie got announced and this collaboration got announced, there was no mention of another composer. And then with the final credits, who's the Jacob Dievitt in front
Marco
of
Marco Beltrami, who...
in his own right is a pretty, you know,
yeah, what's he
seasoned
done?
Composer. So I wonder if he was brought in as part of Fox's, like, oh, this movie's going the wrong way. This Glass thing is too dark, you know? We've got to bring someone in to change
this
too.
Get this guy under control.
Like,
well, actually, I'm trying to look it up right here because at least the way that Wikipedia words it, it sounds like Beltrami was the first guy hired, and then they brought on Philip Glass to help him.
Yeah, I only heard... Like, when the story first came out, I only heard Glass's name mentioned. But, yeah, I thought it was a waste. I mean, like, it didn't... There was nothing in the score that felt like, oh, there's, you know, a touch of Glass right there. Like, I can tell that he worked on this. Like, usually there's some telling moment where you're like, oh, this has to be a Philip Glass. I never felt that at all. In fact, during the movie, I was wondering. I was like, oh, did he get taken off this movie during the whole thing? But then, no, his name was there at the end, so...
So Tim Blake Nelson, he plays a fellow named Dr. Allen, who very clearly becomes the antagonist. And it got to a point where I laughed anytime he was on screen because he was always chewing gum in this very ominous manner. It was hilarious.
He was doing it when he was in the suit, too. And I'm like, no, you don't do that. That's not, like, sanitary. How is this allowed?
He's in an environment suit chewing gum.
She'll do it.
That's awesome.
I wonder if he ever...
How you doing?
I wonder if it was always the same piece, if he just never spit it out.
Oh, God, that's... No, it's not.
Interesting really. Fun fact.
Tim Blake Nelson. I love Tim Blake Nelson, though.
I always see him as more, like, I haven't seen him in too many things, but I always see him in more or less kind of like a good guy kind of role, or...
Yeah, it's like, kind of like the innocuous kind of...
I mean, I guess the first role I remember seeing him in was in the 2003 film Holes, which was based off the children's book, which I still have a special place in my heart for that movie.
I've never seen that movie.
I don't know. You guys can hate on Shia LaBeouf all you want, but
I would like
him,
to do that.
Sigourney Weaver, John Voight, Tim Blake Nelson in that film. So I guess he's bad in that one, but he's like... He's trying so hard to be a good guy. And then, of course, like, my favorite Coen Brothers film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Where he just plays, like, the guy who's just trying to get everybody to get along.
We thought you was a
frog.
Everett, my beard itches.
It's like one of my favorite lines.
He's like the best character because he's just along for the ride. He's not there for he doesn't have any he's not harboring any harsh feelings for anyone. He's just he doesn't even really want to take part in the crimes or anything. He's just like, I gotta get the family farm back before I can start thinking about that.
Oh man, I haven't thought of that movie in a while.
I love that movie. Let's just talk about that movie.
Jason, what was your favorite line?
We thought you was a frog.
Oh no, you missed. We thought you was a horny toad.
No.
Yes.
Technically, he's right. Yeah.
Zing.
No fucking way.
Favorite line, my ass.
Them sirens lived him up and turned him into a horny toad. All right. Now that we're really off track. Back to him in a superhero film, because he was in the 2008 version of the Hulk, which was interesting, because in this film he's, like, clearly a villain. Not a super villain, but just a villain. But if I recall correctly from the 2008 version of the Hulk, they were almost poising him to be a super villain. Because I think he was just some guy that Bruce Banner was contacting because he's, hey, you know, I think you might be able to help me, like, control my powers or something like that.
Yeah, he was just lesser scientist who...
And so he was just kind of like a neutral character at first, but then something happened towards the end where... Didn't he get, like, infected with something and it was kind of alluding that he might be getting powers and could return in the
sequel? I honestly can't remember.
Were a sequel to ever happen, which is probably unlikely.
Not with any of the characters from that movie. Or not with any of the actors, I guarantee it.
Am I the only one remembering like that scene? Because I thought they were like the way it was shot. It almost seemed like, ooh, he might turn a little evil, maybe go a little mad with power.
I just don't care to think about that movie.
I don't care to think about many superhero movies, but yet I do, for the sake of the podcast.
Your dedication is—it's unparalleled.
Your sacrifice is unappreciated.
Damn!
Ouch! Damn! Fine. I thought you was a toad. We thought you was a toad. You're right. I screwed it up.
At least you can admit that. Now I just need you to admit your mistake in the last episode.
That I missed. That I said Bronson instead of Brosnan. Yeah, I admit that, and I will happily admit all the mistakes that I'm guaranteed to make over the course of however long this lasts.
Yeah, I had announced a mistake I had made in the previous episode, and so...
Yeah, I actually had thought of a couple at one point and didn't write them down and forgot them again. So.
Yeah, as soon as I can get on track with posting these episodes, then maybe we can start our own correction segment.
Yeah, it's probably going to be necessary.
Where we apologize to everybody.
Yeah, well, sorry, we mispronounced your name.
It was cool that they did have more people of color in a superhero film, because most of superhero films lately have just been a bunch of white dudes. Mm-hmm. So that was nice. Granted, it's bad. It's unfortunate that it was in a bad movie, but...
Let's jump into our episode theme, which is chase sequences. I went ahead and chose something that wasn't necessarily a sequence. I have been very fond of the movie Apocalypto, the 2006 film by Mel Gibson. However, I decided not to choose that one. Jason is giving me a thumbs down. Don't get me wrong, I love that movie to death.
I'm glad to hear you like that movie. I really love that movie.
I don't know why nobody else is talking about that as much.
I love that movie.
However, I feel like there was another film which preceded it by a couple decades, which I could probably group into the same field of quality. This is the 1965 movie The Naked Prey, directed by Cornel Wilde. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I've heard of it, have not seen it.
Do you know what it's about?
Not really.
It is about a bunch of guys, a group of men on a safari, and of course they offend a native tribe. So the native tribe goes ahead and, you know, grabs them, kidnaps them, and slaughters most of them, but then takes one of the men and basically condemns him to, quote, the lion's chance, which is sending him out into the wild to be hunted.
Okay, so it's like kind of a variation on Most Dangerous Game?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
So...
And it was made in 65, but it takes place, like, it's a contemporary film? Like, it takes place in 65 as well? Or
Yeah, it does. I think it, I'm pretty sure it takes place in like tribal Africa.
Right. But in like modern time, not like.
Yeah. In 1965.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I have heard of that movie, but I've never gotten around to it. I'll have to make a point to it. So the chase would be like just like the second half of the movie or the second two thirds
like
of the movie?
Nearly the entire film. So I'd always thought of Apocalypto as a foot chase that rivaled many car chases. And so thinking on that, I had to travel back in time and see if anyone thought about that beforehand. But you're right. The Most Dangerous Game is something that I overlooked. So
The Most Dangerous Game. Yeah, it would. I don't remember when it's written, but there's been.
I think it was the early 30s.
Or late a couple. 20s. I think there were a couple versions. Of
well, there's a couple.
Oh, there's been so many.
There's
versions
a couple movie versions, you know, and a bunch, you know, probably a bunch that are not called A Dangerous Game. But I was thinking of like the original story. Like, I'm not sure when that exactly was written, and I don't really want to look it up.
Yeah,
but I think the first movie version was
like
29
here.
Or 30. We can
books. What is that?
Don't listen to him.
1924.
Okay, so even earlier than I thought. Yeah, I have to check out The Naked Prey. I wonder if it is. I wonder if it was an influence on Gibson.
I'm just going to go with a scene from an animated movie, which is also a superhero film called The Incredibles. And that's the scene which they refer to as the 100-mile dash, I think, which is when Dash and Violet are first discovered on the island owned by Syndrome, when Syndrome sends his drones out to go hunt them down. And Dash takes off, and just basically, you get to see all the bits of the island, you get to see the forest, you get to see the desert, you get to see parts of the ocean. And Dash is just trying to outmaneuver these guys in these hovercrafts. And I really love that scene. I think it's because it's a chase scene without any real vehicles. Well, I guess except the hovercrafts. But it's another, like you said, like foot chase scene. So there's that going for it. And I think just because it's an animated film, too, they can play around with the different angles. They can play around just with the physics of the chase scene, too. It doesn't have to abide by just, you know, typical car chase scenes, you know, restricted to certain roads and stuff like that. And it's just a fun scene overall. It's like the highlight of the movie. Sometimes I'll just watch the movie like just for that scene. And then, of course, the rest of the movie is great too. But that scene is probably my favorite scene in the whole film.
For someone who doesn't like superhero movies, you can't really shut up about them, do they?
I love that one. That one's great.
No, that one is great, absolutely. And that is a great scene too. My pick, since Matt is making me narrow it down to one pick, is also a foot chase, and it coincidentally kind of brought up when we were not recording. It's from Catherine Bigelow's Point Break, and it begins up in the aftermath of a robbery where the bad guys are all in like presidential masks, and proceeds through like neighborhoods, like backyards, and through houses and over fences. And it's just really well shot, and the way it's the production design is like just really bright. Like you know, you'll jump over a fence and it'll be like all like bright red toys and just really random colors. It's just a really exciting, kinetic scene that Catherine Bigelow shoots really well. And then you know it ends with, not to spoil it, I know I haven't seen it. It's not gonna spoil the whole movie, but it ends with Johnny Utah, the Keanu Reeves character, the cop, basically like letting the Bodie character played by Patrick Swayze go when he had him in his sights. He could have killed him or shot him, but he lets him go kind of because he's in love with him a little bit. But really good movie. I wish Catherine Bigelow would make genre movies again instead of the politically minded war films that she seems to be obsessed with lately, because she was a great genre filmmaker, and that's my favorite chase scene.
As far as foot chases go, that's a really exciting scene. That goes like inside of people's houses. It goes through their windows.
Yeah.
And in the camera work, you know, it's almost point of view a lot of the time.
A lot of times. Or it's like, it'll be like, you know, Bodie in the lead. Like, the camera will be behind him. It'll kind of, like, he'll come to a fence or something. He'll jump over, and then you'll see the Keanu Reeves character, Johnny Utah, like, come in, and he'll get in the shot. And then the camera will kind of start to go over the fence, like, it's climbing too, and then it'll cut to, like, a further point. And they do that a couple times. Really great, well-edited chase scene.
Well, that's going to conclude this episode and our review of Fantastic Four. You are listening to Matthew Baltz,
Jason Callen,
and Jake Moradian.
This is The Phi Effect. Thank you for listening.